Want to let them know it's time? We got a quilting bee going on over here. That's what you get when you don't make me a quilt. Good morning to everybody. We are getting ready to go into some extremely interesting discussion that can be difficult to understand. But I think we can give us some premise, some foundation for our understanding of the discussion. We're on lesson 21. Does anybody need a copy? Turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 24. Here's the thing. We can go back into the book of Daniel. We can look into Ezekiel. And what we can see there is a commonality of language and prophecies, even into the book of Revelation. And we will see a lot of things that are common. One of the questions that we have to ask ourselves on the front end is, does that mean that they are all talking about the very exact same thing? And it doesn't necessarily mean that. We talk about, I love my wife. I love my dog. I love the game of golf. Am I saying the same thing about all three of those? Well, let's hope not. Okay? We get the difference. And we make the distinction in our minds as we talk about these things based upon the context of what we're talking about. So when we look at some of the figurative language that was a Hebrewism, if you will, used quite often in the Hebrew language, we see a commonality of descriptions and statements and things that are being said. It doesn't necessitate that the context is the same. It just means that the expression that's being used is an expression that can be used in a lot of different areas. We are going to see that as we come now into Matthew 24. On the front end, let's take off the table as a point of discussion, premillennialism. There is nothing in Matthew 24 that speaks to Christ returning, that there would be a rapture, and I'll explain some of these things as we get into them, and then a 1,000-year reign, and then Christ returning. We want to kind of get that thought out of our mind, because I'll tell you this. There are some who will look at Matthew 24, and that's the direction that they will take it, and they will pull things out of the book of Revelation and try to fit it into the conclusion that they've already drawn. Don Patton, and I think I've told the story before, how he was a member of the church. He's probably gone by now. He's got, if not, he's ancient. But he was a professor of geology. Now, I want to say Indiana University, might have been Illinois, somewhere back there. But he was one of those who was out looking for the ark and had gone over to Turkey and was looking. But he said he walked into a friend of his, another scientist, and he was in his lab and he had a square foot block of peat moss. And Patton says, what are you doing? He says, well, I'm testing this for its age. Oh, Well, what are you coming up with? Well, about 5,000 to 7,000 years old. Okay. But the guy then says this, but I already know that it's 40,000 or 50,000 years old. So I'll keep testing it until I get the right answer. If you already know the answer, what are you testing it for in the first place, right? If it's for me, tell them I'm busy. That's what people will tend to do and how they tend to study the Bible. I already know the answer. It's okay to use musical instruments. So I'm just going to go ahead and study the Bible, and I will make what I see God saying to fit the answer that I already know to be true. See, that's kind of putting the cart before the horse. We need to let the Scriptures give us the answers. Even if we don't like what we see, or if we think we would like it to be something different. All of that's just kind of the preamble to our discussion that we're getting ready to start. It is time to start our class. Charles, can you lead us in that word of prayer, please? Amen. Thank you. Okay. If you went through your lesson, you will notice that Brother Taylor kind of just barely scratches the surface of the discussion going on in Matthew 24. There are two basic understandings, and it all starts with how you view the discussion. Are there three questions that Jesus is answering, or is there one question that Jesus is answering? And we will see that as we get into this discussion and concept of questions. The disciples come to Jesus. And Jesus came out, I'm in verse 1, Jesus came out from the temple, was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. You ever been to New York? I've been there one time. Well, I was in the city 3 or 4 times, but because I was in New Jersey, and we were going over in the afternoon evenings to see New York. I'm the typical tourist. I'm walking around doing this, looking at all the tall buildings and everything. That's what the disciples were doing with Jesus. Look at all these big buildings. These disciples were fishermen from the Sea of Galilee for the most part. They were farm people. They were rural people. Jerusalem was a big city to them. And they're kind of all agog, if you will, pointing these buildings out to Jesus. So Jesus looks at him and says, you see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which will not be torn down. So Jesus is telling them, yeah, this is pretty impressive, these big buildings. They're all going to get torn down. They're not going to be here forever, as impressive, pardon me, as they look. So, verse 3, He was sitting on the Mount of Olives, and the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be?" What things? The things that Jesus just said. Not one stone's going to be left standing. Tell us when these things will be. What will be the sign of your coming? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? There's your three questions. Or there's your one question. How can verse 3 be either one question or three questions? As we go through Matthew 24, we're going to try to hit both viewpoints, okay? I may not do a great job of that, but that's going to be our effort so that we don't try to predispose anybody one way or the other. Come to your own conclusion. I don't necessarily think that either conclusion is not doctrinal. I think that dependent upon how you view these things, it will shade or influence you in how you view other things, a la Daniel, Ezekiel, Revelation. Okay? So, one question in verse 3, or three questions? Okay, but they are three specific questions. Well, then you're thinking of it as one question. Okay? The three questions. Can you see how this could be three different questions? Let's look at it. When are these things going to happen? When are these buildings going to be torn down? We know when they were torn down. When? About 70 A.D. at the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay? Eric sends this message when Christ sits on his throne that and rules. Well, that's one of the answers, depending again on how you look at verse 3. We know that 70 A.D., the buildings were torn down. Is that the same time of his coming? No, it's not. But we'll talk about that. Okay? The coming of Christ can be viewed primarily in one of two ways. One, we can say that the coming of Christ happened on the day of Pentecost, or actually even during his death, burial, and resurrection. He was established as the Christ. The resurrection of Jesus, when God raised him from the dead, validated his claim that he was the Messiah. The kingdom didn't occur until the day of Pentecost, some 50 days later, give or take. Okay? So that's the coming of Christ. That's different than when these buildings would be torn down, the destruction of Jerusalem. We'll come back to a discussion on that. And third, what's going to be the end of the age? That's one viewpoint, the end of the Jews. Now, let's come back and view why that this could be viewed as one question. Remember who was asking the question? It was his disciples. They were all Jews. What did they view as the primary feature of the Mosaical law? What was the seat of the law of Moses? That's the answer, because it was in the temple where God dwelt.
in the most holy place. So that's what they are looking at when they're talking about this build, these buildings, and that's what they understood Jesus' reference to be of tearing the building down. Remember the other discussion when Jesus says, tear it down and I'll raise it up in 3 days? They're saying, how can you possibly do this in 3 days? Same type of context. Okay? As far as the disciples were concerned, all of this is just one question. That's easily seen. When is it going to happen? When is it going to be torn down? And in their mind, when it's torn down, is the end of the age for the law of Moses, and will also be his coming. Because they still didn't understand he wasn't going to establish an earthly kingdom. They did get the concept that when he came and established an earthly kingdom, that whatever kingdom that the Jews had, not much, being under the rule of the Romans, was going to be transformed or changed pretty drastically. So, in the Jews, in the disciples' viewpoint, yeah, this is pretty easily understood to be one question. When's the temple going to get destroyed? That's the sign of your coming, and that will be the end of the age. We can also see, once we begin to look at, and here's where the real crux of this discussion comes into play. When we begin to look at Jesus' answers, okay, and there are three distinctive answers that he gives, it becomes pretty easy to see the implication that Jesus viewed verse 3 not as one question, but as three questions. When is this building going to get torn down? It'll get torn down at the destruction of Jerusalem. What's the sign of your coming? Well, that's different, because I'm not coming at the destruction of Jerusalem. I will have come, in your understanding, either the day of Pentecost or my resurrection, or I will come again at the second coming. Well, when's the end of the age? Well, what age are we talking about? If it's the Jewish age, then that kind of falls at around AD 70 in one viewpoint. But quite frankly, in reality, it falls on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2. And that's what the whole book of Hebrews is about. That the law of Moses was fulfilled when Christ was hanging on the cross and said, it is finished. The Jewish age had come to an end. They didn't know it. It's kind of like the chicken without a head running around the yard. It doesn't know it's dead yet, but it's coming. Well, the law of Moses was fulfilled. It was done on the day of Pentecost. The Jews that kept trying to practice it just didn't know it. So that would be one understanding of the end of the age. The other understanding is the end of human life as we understand it. Well, as we move on, we're going to see what can be understood to be a distinction, though, to be honest, for those who cling to this verse 3 as being one question, it's not all that difficult to take and see in Jesus' response how he is responding to one question. Okay? The difficulty with understanding it to be the three questions is the idea of the ending of the age. It's pretty easy to get the three questions of when are the buildings going to be destroyed, when are you coming? But that end of age, a little bit difficult, because it can be easily seen to be either the age of the Jew and the Mosaic law, and or the end of time, if you will. Many people point to the destruction of Jerusalem as being the final culmination of the end of the law of Moses. I struggle with that personally, simply because to me, the law of Moses ended at the day of Pentecost. That was the culmination. Yes, I get the idea that the temple was ultimately destroyed in AD 70 and the Jews no longer had their seat of worship, as Nona pointed out. I get that. But it had already happened. Just because in their perception they didn't understand it doesn't mean that it hadn't occurred yet. They're the chicken running around without a head. So, verse 3 is pivotal. How do we look at verse 3? One question, three questions. But understand this, as I prefaced our discussion, there's nothing about premillennialism involved in this. Who knows what the rapture is? Actually, in the terminology of the book, in the book of Revelation, the rapture comes before we all go to heaven. You're driving down the road, and your wife and or husband sit next to you, and you're talking to them, and there's no answer, and all of a sudden you look over, and they're gone. That's the rapture. That Christ will, and some people say it's already happened. There were a few people I wish he had taken that he didn't. He left. Yeah, what a rotten surprise that was. But Christ is supposedly going to come in secret, and he will take certain ones, but not everybody. And not everybody's, no one is even going to know that he had come except those that got taken. Then there will come a time when he comes back and brings those with him. And boy, you talk about a disappointment. Now I got to go back to earth. And will establish his kingdom and reign for 1,000 years. The 1,000-year reign. That's why it's called pre-millennialism. Pre-1,000 years or before 1,000 years. Okay? Then, after the 1,000-year reign, there's going to be this big battle that they call Armageddon, which would disappoint Bruce Willis tremendously. How many get that reference? Thank you. There was a movie Bruce Willis made about the asteroid or something that was, okay, called Armageddon. That this battle would then occur. Jesus would come out victorious, and he would at that point in time take home his followers. While there's an awful lot wrong with that whole viewpoint, one of the primary things wrong with it is this. We don't get a second chance. We're one and done. It's given unto man once to live, and then the judgment. That's it. We're living it right now. We will be judged on what we say and do right now. We're not going to have an opportunity to be raised from the grave and live for another 1,000 years to try to get it right. It would be nice, but it's not going to happen. That's a direct contradiction to what God says in His Scriptures. And that's beside all of the other things that are wrong with that particular viewpoint. Okay? So, that being taken off the table, we have one of two options. We understand the whole of Matthew 24, including verse 3, being one question, and the answer being the destruction of Jerusalem. Or, we see in Christ's response to this that he separates the three statements in verse 3 and treats them as separate questions. Okay? That's what we're going to look at as we go through the rest of beginning Christ's response in verse 4. Have I muddied the waters really bad, or do you kind of have the direction of what we're going to try to look at now? Questions or comments? Oh, I'd like to think I really did a good job of explaining that, but I think I know better. You guys are just being nice to me. All right. Christ's response. If somebody could please read verses 4 through 14. Okay. Do you see a chronological timeline in verses 4 through 14? Not necessarily dates. This is going to happen in 30 AD. This will happen. No. But do you see a chronological timeline of events that are going to happen? Charles, please read verse 14 again. Okay. Say it again. Yeah, it hasn't ended. But there are some things that Christ inserts into this to give us a time frame in our minds. Don't let anybody mislead you. There's going to be a lot of people that show up that are going to claim to be Christ. Historically speaking, that occurred. Lots of people showed up. I'm the Christ. Guess what? It's still happening today. People showing up claiming to be the Christ. Okay? Wasn't that what David Koresh said in Waco? I'm the Christ. It's what Charles Manson said. It's what Jim Jones said. And these are all just relatively modern day guys. There were a ton of them. And what Christ says is, don't let these people mislead you. They're teaching error. They're going to mislead many. At the same time, you're going to be hearing of rumors of wars, rumors of wars. Don't become so frightened that you lose your focus on God and on Christ. Why? Because these things have to happen. I'm not going to sit here and tell you that the war in Ukraine has to happen. I don't know what God's overall plan is. Maybe something was going on that needed to be fixed. I don't know. This is what Etheline says, and it's a profound statement. Thank you, Etheline. She said, when we began to look for signs, we set ourselves up to be deceived. Okay, Eric brings up that it could be the time that Christ is talking about in Matthew 28 and 18. And that's true. But kind of hear what Etheline said. If I go out and start to look for things, I'm going to find them. I can go through the Old Testament and I can find things there that I say, well, that's got to be pointing to Jesus. We had a discussion, oh, it's been a while back. We got into a big discussion about a hammer. And you know what? Sometimes a hammer is just a hammer. Sometimes when things that we're reading, that they're pertinent to those people, but they don't necessarily have this long-range, futuristic whatever. Some of them do. We read a lot of prophecies in the Old Testament. Prophecies that were spoken to people at that day and time and were intended for people at that day and time. But we can see a future discussion in them. But when we begin to start looking for things, well, we can find them. And unfortunately, all too often, what we find isn't necessarily accurate. We have to be careful. That's why we are to study to show ourselves approved. So Jesus said, these things have to happen. Nation's going to rise against nation. There's going to be famines. There's going to be earthquakes. That's almost a daily event. Nowadays, if an earthquake happens in Timbuktu, we know about it within an hour. Back then, it might have been a year before they ever found out about it. We have the advantage, if you want to call it that, of the electronic news system. But all of this isn't unusual. This is things that are going on. But now note verse 8. These things are merely the beginning of birth pangs. Birth of what? What? Go way back. Go back 2,000 plus years. What happened at the crucifixion of Jesus? Earthquakes. How about the birth pangs of the church? The beginning. Birth is a beginning, is it not? So you were getting there. We needed, you know, follow the yellow brick road. Okay. The birth pangs of the church. So we have a time frame. All of these things are occurring leading up to the establishment of the church. Eric says that one of the commentaries that he uses says that a clear aim of this chapter is to prevent premature excitement about the end coming. And Christ did that with the disciples quite often. He said, don't panic. He said, there's going to be plenty of time. One of the things is what Charles read for us in verse 14. It gave us a definitive time frame. Okay? We'll see that. But this verse 8 tells us all of these things are occurring leading up to the birth. Well, the only thing that we see becoming new or beginning during this time frame is the church. Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost. Okay? Now he goes on in this time frame of events. He says, then they will deliver you to tribulation. Who's the you he's talking to? Back up to verse 3. It's the disciples that have come to him. We understand that terminology, the disciples, to be talking about the 12. Though I could not argue against the fact that those in the upper room, the 120, might have been there also, because we're told that they were with him from baptism to ascension. So they might have been part of that. But this is a very select group that he is speaking to. He says, then they're going to deliver you, disciples, up to tribulation. and they're going to kill you. And you will be hated by all nations on account of my name. Can you see how that's a time frame? We have the things in verse 4 and 5, 6, coming up, 7. Then he gets to 8. Those are all preambles to the birth of the church. Okay? Then the church has happened. You guys are all going to get taken, tribulation, and you're going to get killed. Charles. I think 5, 6, and 7, to be very honest, are leading up to. So they've already been happening, leading up to the establishment of the church. Probably continued past it. Absolutely. We know that the birth has to be speaking of the church, and the delivering up the disciples to the tribulation obviously occurred after the establishment of the church. So 8 and 9 flow very nicely together. Okay? He's not talking to the Jews here. He's talking specifically to the disciples. Well, he answers. Yeah, but he answers that in the latter part of verse 9. Why are they delivered up? He says, on account of my name. That's not the Jews in total. That's only the disciples or those that are professing the name of Christ. So that gives us the definition of the group that he is speaking to. I believe it to be. Who else, because of his name, was persecuted? Yeah. So I believe that that's the only answer that it can be. Because he defines the group, it's because of my name. And we see that beginning in Acts all the way through. All of the persecution that Paul endured. All the persecution that all of the apostles endured. It all came about because of Christ. It wasn't a general persecution to the nation. Okay? Questions then down through verse 9. I wouldn't say that it doesn't. Are we being persecuted today because of the name of Christ? If we are, then yeah, we fall into the category. Yeah, I would agree with that. Peter talks about those that are being persecuted for the name of Christ. So yeah, I would think so. Okay, verse 10 then. At that time, what time? He's just given us a time frame in verses 8 and 9. At that time. So what's the time frame that he's given us in verses 8 and 9? Say it, Jeff. What? Okay, the time of tribulation, the time when the disciples are being put to death, the birth of the church at that time. So that time frame isn't, what's the word, pointillier, meaning a specific moment in time. It's a probably lasted hundreds of years, okay? But during the time frame of the church and of the preaching of the gospel, at that time, many will fall away and will deliver up one another and hate one another. Christ just gave us a prophecy. Keep in mind, what is the concept that he brings up here of falling away? Falling away from what? Christ. falling away from the church, falling away from Christ. Many are going to fall away. Okay? Oh, yes, it did. Absolutely. Prior to the Roman persecution beginning in, I don't know, 50 AD, 60 AD, whenever it began. Prior to that, once the church was established, can you think of anybody that was going around trying to find Christians so that they could be put to death? Saul became Paul. It was a very real experience for me to be a Christian. And because of the persecution, we're worshiping kind of, you know, out of the limelight, if you will. And my brother says, well, I don't agree with what you're doing. So he goes and reports me to Saul. Excuse me. Saul comes and takes me. And I get put to death. Many are going to fall away. And they're going to deliver up one another. And they're going to hate one another because of my name. Christ says that. He says, father, mother, brother, sister, friends. Happened during the Roman persecution. People turning loved ones and relatives in because of the stand that they were taking for the name of Christ. Very real prophecy. This happened. And we can see in the time frame of events of it occurring, that it occurred during that time frame. The establishment of the church, the apostles going out to preach the gospel, and not just the apostles, but all of those that were scattered abroad out of Jerusalem that had believed and were saved. The word, the gospel got to Rome somehow because none of the apostles had gotten there and there was a church in Rome. Okay? So these things are all happening. And many false prophets are going to arise and they're going to mislead many. Is that still happening? Yeah. There's people out there who have congregations of thousands and thousands of members. And all they're doing is misleading people, leading them away from God. And because lawlessness has increased, most people's love will grow cold. Now, there is some discussion on this concept of lawlessness. There's really only two options. One is law of the land. Without law of the land, you typically have anarchy and chaos. The other option is God's law, that without the law of God, you are lawless. Without law of the land, you are lawless. Some people will look at verse 12 and they will say that has to be talking about the conditions that were in Jerusalem prior to AD 70 during the Roman siege, which was what, 2 or 3 years, whatever it was. There was anarchy and chaos inside the city of Jerusalem. And people will say that fits verse 12. Yes, it does. But it also fits verse 12 when you look at this concept of most people's love will grow cold. Love for what? For the word. For each other. For God. The two great commandments, love God and love each other, God's word. And most people's love will grow cold. So this, and they will become lawless, or they will turn away from the law of God. So you can see how verse 12 can go either way, towards the destruction of Jerusalem and or towards the events that were occurring right then, which was about 40 years prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. Verse 13, the one who endures to the end, he's going to be saved. And to me, the kicker is verse 14, which is the culmination of the chain of events that Christ is describing beginning at verse 4. And in verse 14, he says, the gospel, this gospel that does what? That saves people. That is God's law. That is to be loved. Shall be preached in the whole world. Then the end is going to come. Give some consideration to verse 14. We're going to pick up there next week. Time is up. I hope I haven't really stirred up the mud too much. But like I said, because of the difficulty in looking at this and trying to see both sides of the opinion, we can get a little verbose, and I apologize for that. Thank you all. Appreciate your coming, and thank you those at home. Appreciate your comments.